Thanks for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara Byrne. On this Thursday night, NATO celebrated its 75th birthday today as foreign ministers gathered at the alliance's headquarters in Brussels to mark the occasion. It comes just a few weeks after Sweden became the alliance's 32nd member, and as it confronts the threat from Russia, again, the war in Ukraine, and the possibility of Donald Trump returning to the White House. We look at the state of the alliance as it turns 75. And with Canada being one of the 12 founding members back in 1949, it's been under scrutiny for years now for falling well below the 2% defense spending bar set by NATO. We look at our place in the alliance as it stands. The local mall once stood at the very center of economic and social life in many parts of Canada and well beyond, of course. That has faded, as so much of what happened in a mall now happens online. So should we say good riddance to the mall, or will they be missed, or both? Kate Black grew up near the West Edmonton Mall and uses that as a jumping off point for her new book called Big Mall, Shopping for Meaning. And she joins me to talk about malls and nostalgia. But first, there's something about improv that really shows you just how creative and truly funny someone can actually be. Colin Mochrie is about as gifted as you can get, and the Whose Line Is It Anyway mainstay joins me to talk comedy, the memory of Joe Flaherty, who passed away earlier this week at the age of 82, the SCTV cast member, and much more. We've been talking a lot about Canadian comedy this week as we celebrate the life and legacy of former SCTV cast member Joe Flaherty, the actor and comedian originally from Pittsburgh, as we were talking about last night, but who really made his name north of the border as part of the Second City, the SCTV cast, and on shows such as Maniac Mansion and others, passed away on Monday at the age of 82. My next guest is one of the many Canadian comedy legends paying tribute to Flaherty in the past few days, both as a comedian and as a person and as a mentor in some ways. You may know Colin Mochrie from his many years on the hugely successful and long-running show Whose Line Is It Anyway, both the UK version in the 90s and the US version with Drew Carey and Aisha Taylor alongside Ryan Stiles and Wayne Brady. More recently, have a listen.
We're going to start out with a game called Weird Newscasters. This is for all four of you. Colin, we're going to be welcome to the news show.
Welcome to the 6 o'clock news. I'm Thor, but not complaining.
There you have it, the improv show. Weird Newscasters is a good choice, especially for a show like ours. Colin's Canadian roots never went unnoticed.
At the end of the show, we pick an artificial winner. The winner gets to do a little something special with me, and the loser has to go back to Canada where he belongs.
Hello, I'm Colin Mochrie. Have you been to Canada?
I'm going to nominate you all for a Canadian Emmy.
Oh, yes.
A Kemmy.
Which will be as valuable as the points that I give on this show.
Are you all Canadian?
Yes, we are.
Yeah, a little boo hiss there. That is just one big chapter in the decades-long career that encompasses everything from stage to TV and movies, beginning with improv in Vancouver back in the early 80s. He worked with Second City, worked with This Hour Has 22 Minutes, the show Blackfly, hosting Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? She's the Mayor. It goes on and on and on. Right now, he's touring a show that combines improv and hypnosis, appropriately called Hyprov, with master hypnotist Asad Mekki. That's going on as we speak, or it is in the next little while. And it's a great pleasure to have Colin Mochrie on the show with me tonight. Colin, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
It was really interesting just to see the outpouring of reaction from so many in Canadian comedy to the passing of Joe Flaherty. And you wrote something really nice on social media. I saw you talk about him in another interview. You got, like so many, you got to actually perform with him, and you were really impressed, not with him just as a comedian, but just as a human being.
Yeah, an absolutely lovely gentleman. He taught at Humber College, and I know he loved teaching. He loved sort of being a mentor to young improvisers, young sketch people, young comedians. And from the very first time I saw him on SCTV during its first run back in the last century, he was immediately my favorite. I mean, it was such a great cast. Everybody was so good, but I felt he was kind of underrated, and he was doing less than everyone else. You know what I mean? I just loved his stuff.
From where you sit, and just with your time and with all your time in improv and so on, watching SCTV, because of course a lot of us have been watching those old skits, there was kind of an improv nature to them. You never knew how much of it was actually scripted or how much of it they were just doing on the fly. And it felt like Joe Flaherty was the one who sort of, he was at the center of that storm at all times.
Absolutely. I mean, the show really benefited from the cast having a Second City background and being able to improvise. And a lot of them were in the same cast together. So there's that immediate trust and ability to just feed off each other. And I think it was Marty, who said that Joe was the anchor in the show. And I think that's absolutely true. He was sort of the focal point.
How does that work? I mean, to move from SCTV and skit comedy and so on to improv, and of course you've done it all, how important is that chemistry? Because clearly, obviously, on Whose Line, you have incredible chemistry with your improv mates, whether it be Ryan Stiles or Wayne Brady and so on. But how important is that chemistry and how does it work? I guess you need to like each other, right?
Yes, although I've seen people who just despise each other and have a chemistry. I don't know if it's extreme emotion that brings it out, but certainly when improvising, having that chemistry with the person that you're making up stuff with, you know, you sort of need that trust that, you know, if things start going bad, that they're going to stay with me by my side. And certainly with all the guys on Whose Line, all the people I worked with at Second City, You knew that if your ship was sinking, everybody was going to stay with you.
Yeah, that would be, I suppose, having that, because it looks to the outsider like you're working without a safety net completely, right? Especially on Whose Line.
Oh, yeah, but everybody else is your safety net. You know, if one of us isn't on top of it, that's when it's kind of time to, okay, I'm just going to lay back here, let Ryan take control of the scene, and I'll just support him as much as I can. So it really is a give and a go, and it really does help when, it does help when you like the person. And, you know, Ryan and I grew up together, so, you know, I've known him for over 40 years. So there's a real shorthand when we're working together, which is really important in improv.
Yeah. About the Canadianism, because one of the interesting things about Joe Flaherty, I think if you asked anyone, they would say, well, of course he's Canadian, but he grew up in Pittsburgh, right? And then he came to Canada after, but was considered to be an honorary Canadian. It's funny how much comedy in Canada go hand in hand. And yet, even on Whose Line, not the British version, but certainly the American version, how often you were sort of ribbed for being Canadian, nicely so, but still.
Yeah, it's a jealousy for sure. You know, sometimes I think they get very insecure about just the wealth of talent in a country that, yes, we were big, but we don't have the population the States has. But I would say pound for pound, we are very funny people.
Absolutely. You got to work with Second City, right? Didn't you? You did a benefit with both Joe Flaherty and Marty Short, amongst others. I mean, that's a reminder of the amount, the kind of talent, and that's just to name a few, that has come out of this country over the past while.
Doing that, it was like being asked to, you know, sit in and, you know, do you want to play the flute with the Beatles tonight? It was that, because they were so important to me. And they're another thing they have is that they're all incredibly sweet people. They're very lovely, very caring. And they sort of took care of me when, you know, they asked me to join. And I was backstage in the dressing room, and Eugene was trying on different sweaters for his character. You know, Marty had a cushion stuffed under his shirt to make him look like he was hunched over. He taped up his face, and he went, too much? And I said, well, yeah, Marty, the scene's about a PTA meeting, so yeah. And there was just Joe kind of sitting in the corner, just drinking it in and laughing, going, yeah, this is good, this is good. And it was just, it was great to see.
They must have had a lot of admiration for you too, because what you do is slight. I know you've all done everything, but your ability to do improv and do it well, do it in England, do it back here, they must have had a lot of admiration for that as well, because that is not an easy gig.
Sure, let's say it's not. If I told everyone how easy it was, then everybody would be doing it. I mean, I was incredibly fortunate that and not being humble, truly, the only thing I can do well, somehow some British TV show found it and showcased it. So I was very fortunate. And I think all the guys on SCTV and Joe and I mean, Joe, we would talk about it and he would go, oh, I get scared doing the improv. And I went, but I've improvised with you. You're lying to me. And he said, no, I just, if I get into a, it's the games, I think, that made him nervous. If he was doing a character, then he was off to the races.
Well, that's because I've obviously been watching a lot of Whose Line as well in the past little while, and it looks like you're just standing there waiting, especially when the audience questions come in and so on, that the ability to react to that so quickly strikes one as being almost magical, right? And yet it also looks terrifying, because you always think, what is that one time where you're just not going to come up with the right comeback?
There is that. There is that thing where every week, as we were introduced before they started taping, and I think we're on a stage for a show that has to go on television at some point, and we have absolutely nothing. We don't know what we're going to do. All we have is whatever they throw at us and whatever our partners give. And there's a really weird, it is terrifying, but it's also exhilarating.
Yeah. And of course, the audience plays such a big role in it too, because you can tell that they're feeding off you, right? I mean, it's often, especially when it's their question, there's a back and forth with the audience that's really nice to watch.
Yeah, that's why I have nothing but the greatest respect for stand-ups. I think that is the toughest comedy art to sort of master. And with audiences, you know, they have a real, all right, show me what you got kind of a relationship with the comedian. With improvisers, because the audience is giving us suggestions, they have a little more vested interest in us doing well with that. So we have about maybe 10, 15 minutes more where we can suck.
Colin Mockery of Whose Line Is It Anyway? Is starring in a hilarious new show, Hip Rob, Improv Under Hypnosis, featuring master hypnotist Asad Meki. 20 people volunteer to be hypnotized. The most susceptible remain on stage to improvise with Colin while hypnotized.
Wow, Hiprov, it's called. Colin Mockery is with us this half hour. We've been talking about The Late Joe Flaherty and Canadian comedy. Colin, I've watched you do a lot of stuff over the years. Hiprov sounds, speaking of no safety net, Hiprov really sounds like you have no safety net. So they're hypnotized, and then you do improv with them.
Yeah. It is. There are times where I go, "Oh yeah, no, we're still doing this." It's fascinating. It's an odd show because a lot of people, you know, believe that improv is scripted, and a lot of people don't believe in hypnosis. So we put these two art forms nobody believes in and stuck them together, and we make it our mission to make people believe. So have these. Hypnotized subjects who, when Asad Meki, the hypnotist, puts them in a trance, the part of the brain that tells them that you're going to get embarrassed, you're no good at this, is gone. And they just react to everything Asad and I say.
That must make for some, especially on the improv side, that must make for some pretty strange situations, no?
There are some odd, what I love about them is they have no future. They only have the time we're in now. So they're not working towards the end of a scene. They're just adding information. And so it makes it, and such random choices. There was one where I was a superhero looking for a sidekick. And we got from the audience the Gibraltar Kid. So I said to the person auditioning, so you're the Gibraltar Kid. What's your superpower? Do you become strong like a rock? And he went, no, I have a residency in Gibraltar. So if anything happens there, I can take care of it. And I said, your superpower is that you can work in the city you live in? And he went, yeah, it's a good gig. Well, no, quote, unquote, real improviser would ever have made a choice like that.
No, it's not. I mean, you get the laughs, but in it unintentionally. That's although having a regular gig sometimes is a superpower in of itself. So you just give them scenes, like they're sort of, you give them, that would be one of the ideas,
yeah.
Like a superhero needs a new sidekick, go. And these are people who have no improv experience at all, right?
None at all. That's what makes it exciting. It really is fascinating. I mean, and you know, when I'm working with the Whose Line guys, even though we're improvising, I can have a sense of where they're going to go in a scene. Don't have that with these people. I'm constantly taken by surprise. And I think it's actually made me a better improviser because I've really kind of slowed down and just really focused on them because I don't want to miss any of the jams that they throw out my way.
Yeah, and I guess they don't obey any of the sort of rules of improv, right? Because there are certain, even though it's very unscripted, there's a certain sort of box that you're all sitting in that you all understand.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, Assad was the one who came up with the idea for the show because he was taking classes at Second City and he realized that the exercises that we're giving the students to sort of get them out of their head is sort of what he does through hypnosis. He helps suppress that part that's, he helps you get out of your head. So it seemed like a perfect mix to have hypnosis and improv together. And so far, it's worked out.
What do you do to train for that? Or do you train for that? Or do you just show up and just go with it?
That's exactly it. The very well, we couldn't rehearse the show. So the first
Right.
time we did the show was the first time we did the show. And Second City was nice enough to let us take the stage after one of their shows. And just before I walked on, I said, "Oh, Assad, if I ask them to do this, will they do it?" And he said, "I don't know, man. They might. It depends on the
Oh,
subject. Some are so zoned in, some are kind of almost like they're stoned, and some will just look at you." And I thought, wow, that's a question I should have asked a couple of months ago.
what could go wrong? And that's April 9th to 21st, right, at the Mirvor CAA Theatre in Toronto. Awesome. I was going to ask you because we're going to talk about this tonight. You're going to get a chance. The show starts on the 9th. The 8th is the eclipse. You're in Toronto. Are you going to go see the eclipse? It sounds like a big deal.
We have some friends who and a friend who is an amazing cook. So it's going to be a wonderful brunch as we watch the sun eater eat the sun or whatever the thing is.
Yeah, should be, I mean, it should be a good time. Colin, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. Good luck with the show. We'll be looking forward to hearing more stories from Hiprov as they unfold in the next couple of weeks in Toronto.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Tens of millions across North America are getting set to witness the celestial phenomenon on Monday, but the total eclipse, which will really cover a huge swath of from southern Mexico to the Maritimes, that'll descend everyone into total darkness for a few minutes at least. A once in a lifetime event for many, and an opportunity of a lifetime for others. So many are actually going to travel to areas where they're going to get totality. And according to National Geographic, and one of the hottest spots to take in Monday's eclipse is the home of one of the country's most popular tourist attractions. It's not clear just how many people will flock to Niagara Falls on Monday. I guess it sort of depends on the weather. The eclipse is expected to start there around 2:04 p.m. local, lasts for about 2.5 hours, but between 3:20 and 3:23 local time, they're going to get totality. And that in of itself, imagine totality and the falls in one spot. Pretty amazing. So needless to say, a lot of people are heading there, selfie sticks in hand, no doubt. And with the falls being one of the best places in the country to view the eclipse. So they're expecting perhaps hundreds of thousands. They don't quite know. Tens of thousands of vehicles. So they've already declared a state of emergency in the city just so they can handle the influx of people and so on. Not because there's an emergency, but because they want to be prepared in advance. And it's likely to be the largest crowd to ever descend on Niagara. They're coming from near and far, according to local business owners.
We have people from England, we have people from France, we have people from all across the United States, and actually quite a few people from the GTA.
So we thought we would check in and see just how well prepared they are for this eclipse mania that's going to descend on them, probably beginning tomorrow through the weekend and certainly on Monday. Janice Thompson is the president and CEO of Niagara Tourism, and she joins me now. Janice, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Ben. It's great to be with you.
Your website's fantastic. I know you've been planning for this for a long time, but here we are. It is imminent.
It's hard to believe it's less than a week away. And yeah, a couple of years ago when we first started hearing about it and looking at it, it seemed like it would never come, but here it is.
Yeah, Niagara, of course, is not only a place that lots of people visit all through the year, but for this, it is going to be perhaps the best place, one of the best places in North America to witness this totality.
Yeah, we learned that from an article in National Geographic. They declared Niagara Falls, Canada, as the best place in North America from which to experience the eclipse. So that was really something to learn, and we're looking forward to seeing what that feels like.
Needless to say, word is out, I think. So
Yes.
how many people are you expecting, more or less?
Well, we don't know. That's the thing about this. Obviously, it's not something that we've experienced before. We've had major events, and Niagara Falls, we're very accustomed to receiving a lot of visitors and hosting a lot of people. So we do have the infrastructure in place here for it. We'll just have to see what the day brings.
Right. I've been seeing anything from, 50,000 to a million, but I get the impression there's so much interest in this, and Niagara Falls is such a special place to see it, especially for the photo takers, right? It has all the different environments. How are you prepping then for what could be an influx of a ton of people?
Well, the professionals in public safety, road controls, things like that, they're looking after that whole side of it. And we have every confidence in all of them because they do a great job. And being in a tourist destination, they're very accustomed to extraordinary measures. So they're making sure that all that's being addressed. From the tourism side, the hotels have been taking bookings. We have almost full capacity, although there are still some rooms available if people are still looking. The attractions, they're all scheduled to be fully staffed and widely open. The restaurants, everybody's ready. Niagara Falls Tourism, we're presenting a concert in conjunction with the eclipse itself. So, as the period of totality starts, the Niagara Symphony Orchestra will be playing in Queen Victoria Park. And when the totality ends, they'll come back and play again to bring us back into a brighter time. And following that, there'll be a rock concert headed by the Glorious Sons.
Right.
And that goes until 10 o'clock in the evening. Following that, we have fireworks at the falls, over the falls. And then after that, the attractions are open, the casinos are open, the nightlife of Niagara Falls is alive and there. So there are lots of things to keep people in the destination, whether they're staying overnight or just staying here to extend their stay before they drive back to where they came from.
Not bad for a Monday and not a long weekend Monday in April.
It's unbelievable to be a Monday in April. It's incredible.
Tell me a bit about where people can watch, because I think, I've been to Niagara Falls. I think many Canadians have been to Niagara Falls. It can be pretty crowded there, right? Even sort of at the height of tourist season. Where are you sort of planning to put everybody who wants to show up? Because there are lots of different places, not just the falls, where you'll be able to get a really good view of the eclipse.
Most definitely. And we've been looking, as you can imagine, every day. People have gone out at the time with the eclipse is scheduled for. We've had scouts going out and saying, okay, what does it look like? What can you see from here? What can you see from there? And we've been gratified to see, wow, it's so high in the sky that really anywhere in the area you have a good view of it. So we have Queen Victoria Park, of course, where the concert stage is, where the Niagara Symphony will be. There's Table Rock and the whole area there, right at the brink of the falls. The Niagara City Cruises boat, they'll be having sailings during it. So if you want to go out and experience it from the boat, that's also possible. Skyline Tower, the Skywheel, there are different venues that you can go out and see it from.
Right. I don't imagine. Are you looking at the weather forecast or not at this point? Are you trying to avoid it, or are you paying rapt attention to it?
Well, I said it to someone here in our office this morning, stop looking at it because we can't change it. You know,
Right.
it's Mother Nature is truly in charge of this day. Mother Nature is delivering an amazing celestial experience. And we say, okay, you have Niagara Falls, which is a world wonder. Now to have this right over top of us is incredible. The weather, we'll just see what the day brings.
Right. And it truly is a once in a lifetime experience for many areas, but including Niagara. I think the last one was in 1925 and the next one is in 2144. So yes, a once in a lifetime experience for all of us.
It certainly is. It's not to be missed, I would say, right?
Tell me a bit about the glasses and stuff like that, because I'm sure a lot of people will forget. Have you sort of tried to figure out how you're going to get enough protective wear to enough people to witness this if they show up on your doorstep?
Well, we're giving the message to people that the best plan is to make sure that you have some with you. We do have some. The hotels are distributing them to their hotel guests. Some of the attractions are distributing them. We have some retailers that will have them for sale. But the safest bet would be to have some in your pocket when you come so that you're definitely protected.
Right. How about for you and your staff and so on? You're going to want to take some time off to go watch this, right? You don't want to be working between up until about 3 o'clock on Monday afternoon.
Well, we're all going to be working right down at the site. I already have a full day of media interviews scheduled. So
Indeed.
I'll, indeed, I'll be down there. And staff will be busy setting up for the concert that starts right at the eclipse time. So they'll all, everyone's going to be hands on deck that day.
Right. You will take an opportunity. You will take some time to look up, though. I assume when it's happening, you have to.
Oh, definitely. I want to. I definitely, for that short period, for sure, no one should miss it, I would say.
And for those of us, such as myself, who will not be able to get to Niagara or anywhere near on Monday, I was looking on your website and you are actually going to be offering a way that people outside of Niagara can watch what's happening in Niagara on Monday.
Exactly. And Niagara Falls, because of its natural beauty and its attraction year round, there's always something to see at it. A live stream is something that's always offered here. So we're very happy to be able to offer that. And of course, we have professional photographers who will be on site capturing the experience. So in the hours and days after the eclipse, you'll be able to see it on our social media. There'll be lots and lots of exposure, I'm sure, and lots of international media going to be there as well on site to capture it. So it's a message that's going to get around the world very quickly.
Right, and that's at niagarafallstourism.com where you can see that that live stream as well.
That's right, Ben. Yes.
Well, listen, we're almost there. Best of luck, Janice. I'm assuming it's going to be the center of attention on Monday if it isn't already on the weekend when people start to show up. So just keep my fingers crossed for nice clear skies and we'll be watching. Thanks so much.
Give me a call on Tuesday.
We're talking about the sun this half hour, the eclipse, the total eclipse of the sun coming up on Monday afternoon local time in a huge swath. I mean, at least in this part of the world, in North, in Canada, at least it'll be in the mid-afternoon. Hamilton and Niagara are going to get total totality, and that will sweep right up the 401, more or less, through sort of Kingston and then into kind of the into the Cornwall area, then into Quebec and Sherbrooke, and then down into the eastern townships. I was saying earlier that the forecast I was looking at, Environment Canada, showed a mix of sun and cloud for Niagara and Hamilton and so on Monday. And now I'm reading something where it looks like they're going to have cloud move in, apparently, that Niagara and Hamilton will be those areas might experience heavier cloud cover than elsewhere on Monday. So fingers crossed that doesn't happen. 4 days is a pretty long time meteorologically, so we'll see if that doesn't change. But for the time being, things looking iffy. But as the head of Tourism Niagara said, they're not looking or trying not to look at the weather forecast because what can you do to control that? Well, here's something you can control. If you're going to be out there watching this total solar eclipse, tens of millions of people, of course, across North America will do this. And new research shows it's not just staring up at it without the proper safety gear on that can lead to some injuries. There's increased dangers down below as well. Research into the last total eclipse that hit parts of North America back in 2017 shows a pretty significant increase in car crashes and fatalities. The analysis published in the journal JAMA Internal Medicine last week found that there was a 31% increase in traffic risks around the time of the eclipse. And believe it or not, it's not because people sort of lose their minds or stop in the middle of the road to watch the actual totality. It's before and after. So we thought we'd figure out more about, or at least find out more about it. Dr. Don Rettelmeyer is co-author of that analysis. He's a professor of medicine at the University of Toronto and a senior scientist at Sunnybrook Research Institute. And he joins me now. Dr. Rettelmeyer, thank you.
It's nice to be here, Ben.
We talk so much about the inherent threats of sort of staring up at the sun during an eclipse, but I gather one of the bigger threats out there happens before and after the eclipse, and that's just getting there. What did you find?
Yeah, but that's but that's sort of a point of our research. Solar retinopathy is not the only risk. We found about a 31% increase in fatal crashes, not at the moment of totality, but in the hours of before and after.
Right. So this is really about that mass movement of people going, trying to get there and then trying to get out, I presume.
Yeah, that's our best single explanation. Very much like the increased risk of a traffic crash around Thanksgiving.
Right. So, I mean, you went back, I think, to look at the 2017 experience, and that was another eclipse, a total solar eclipse that covered a really quite a wide swath of the US and a lot of people. And I guess we're witnessing something even bigger this time. There's even more people who can move or presumably watch or get outside or get in their cars, as would be the case, to go see witness this one.
Yeah, It covers a lot of ground, Mexico, the United States, and Canada. Unlike most solar eclipses that occur over oceans or unpopulated sectors of the globe, but this will play through three different countries all during prime time.
So when you looked at this research, I mean, 31% is a pretty big number. What is it comparable to? I mean, you mentioned Thanksgiving earlier. I guess that's another, that's the busiest travel day of the year, usually up until American Thanksgiving, right?
Yeah, I think, there are other analogies. If you decide to unbuckle your seatbelt while driving, something I would certainly not recommend,
Yeah.
that's associated with about a 40% increase in the risk of a fatal crash.
Wow. And what were the hypotheses that you came up with to try to explain this? I mean, obviously the mass movement, you have more people moving around, which in of itself would no doubt raise the risk of certain things, but there are other factors at play that you were looking into as well here.
Yeah, that's right. Some of the other factors are travel on unfamiliar roadways, distraction in the aftermath of a celestial spectacle, a few people who are intoxicated from these eclipse-related festivals, and some individuals viewing the eclipse from unsafe roadside locations. But the main explanation is just the increased amounts of driving.
Do you get the sense, I mean, your research has received quite a bit of coverage. Do you get the sense that authorities, especially after what happened in 2017, that authorities are alert to this now, that they're alert to what may be about to happen on Monday?
There's some awareness, but there needs to be increased awareness. It doesn't mean believing in supernatural forces. It doesn't mean stopping the eclipse. What it does, though, justify is just reinforcing the standard safety reminders. Almost all fatal crashes can be completely avoided by a small change in driver behavior. Respect speed limits, signal your turns, yield right of way. Allow more headway. Always use your seatbelt. Never drive drunk. It seems so banal, but that type of a reinforcement is especially important.
Yeah, don't have an eclipse in judgment is what one I think the U.S. Federal Highway Administration is saying about this these days.
Yeah, well, that's a nice way of putting it. Also, keep in mind that the single most dangerous hour we found with the eclipse wasn't at the moment of totality. Far from it. It was about, between 6 p.m. and 7 p.m. after the eclipse was over, when
Wow.
people were returning home. That's when individuals seem to let down their guard.
That seems, I wonder, that seems counterintuitive because you would think that the most dangerous time would be those rushing to get to where they need to be so as not to miss it. And therefore, they're on unfamiliar roads. They're probably, they're in a hurry. They want to be somewhere, and that would lead to sort of bad decisions. But it's actually afterwards, which is, yeah, that is interesting.
Yeah, it's a similar pattern that we see actually every day of the year during the commute to and from work, where the afternoon rush hour is about 25% more dangerous than the morning rush hour, even though it's the same drivers, same vehicles, same roadway.
Wow. And I guess in this case, one of the things that stood out as well is that during the totality itself, in that minute when in fact we're all kind of plunged into a strange darkness, that in fact you didn't see a raise. Like that's not necessarily a dangerous time. I guess everyone has kind of stopped, right?
Yeah, that's what's counterintuitive about it. In fact, we actually find a dip, a decrease right at the hour of totality, presumably because so many people are stationary for the moment. The difficulty is that they more than make up for it afterwards.
Indeed. So I guess the crux of this is just be, I mean, in this case, information is knowledge is power, right? In this case, so just be aware that this is a phenomenon that seems to exist when we have these celestial phenomenons above.
Yeah, and that, one small distraction can change your life forever. I work at Sunnybrook, which is Canada's largest trauma center, and we are looking for a little bit less business.
Yeah, no kidding. In this case, I know you're very busy and have lots on your plate, but you know that Toronto's getting about 99% totality. You can go not too far down the QEW and see 100% totality. What are you up to on Monday?
Oh, I mean, I'll go to the eclipse as well. Who can resist? It's just so
Course.
enchanting. But I will absolutely take my own research seriously and drive especially carefully before and after.
Well, Dr. Edelmeyer, I appreciate your time and your insight on this. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much for your interest in our work.
You may have noticed this week that the Liberals are making an awful lot of announcements. They've been out every single day trying to get ahead of their budget coming out on April 16th, essentially dropping the highlights of the budget beforehand, very much trying to take some initiative back as we head out of the Easter holiday around the affordability issue. And it's really been the big one, mostly around housing. So the announcement today was a $1.5 billion fund to acquire existing apartment buildings in an effort to protect rental units and ensure they remain affordable. So in other words, try to buy up some of these buildings to make sure that they're not bought up by others who have profit in mind to try and keep those affordable rental units affordable. The Canada Rental Protection Fund is designed to save thousands of rental units from being sold and turned into higher price market units. At a time, of course, we know the cost of housing is way out of reach for many, the cost of rent way out of reach for many. And it's the latest, again, in a series of housing pledges from the Trudeau government as they are under increasing pressure or continued pressure to do something about the country's shortage of affordable housing.
People are being priced out of their communities, and that's not okay. So we have to help nonprofits and community partners acquire units and preserve rents at a stable level. That's why we're here to announce the $1.5 billion Canada Rental Protection Fund.
And that was the Prime Minister announcing the fund today. You may know this already. The typical price of a home across the country is now more than $700,000. And the average monthly market rent in Canada for a one-bedroom apartment is about $2,000. Now, that varies depending on where you are, higher in some, lower in others. But that's really where we're at. And rentals alone have just skyrocketed of late. But some bad news out today on the affordability front. Things are likely to get more expensive, not less, over the next few years. Here's why. A report from the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation is forecasting that home prices could match peak levels seen in early 2022 by next year and reach new highs by 2026. And while the agency, the CMHC has forecast in the past that Canada is going to need an additional 3.5 million units built by 2030 just to restore affordability levels. Instead, because there's a lag here, it's actually going in the wrong direction. The number of housing starts continues to fall this year because of that lagged effect of higher interest rates on new construction, with a recovery only expected next year as interest rates come back down and in 2026. And despite an increase in rental housing coming onto the market in 2023, there has been a lot of rental construction in the past little while. Supply is not forecast to keep up with demand. So that's going to mean higher rents and lower vacancy rates will continue in the years to come. We thought we would dig into this a little more. Who better to do that than Bob Dugan? He's the chief economist for the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation. And he joins me now from Ottawa. Bob, thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
So perhaps not a big surprise here, but sobering for those who are waiting for some relief. What have you found for housing prices, at least over the next couple of years? It doesn't look like they're going down.
No, I mean, this is all tied to the outlook for the economy, right? We've had a period of relatively high inflation and high interest rates. And during that time, house prices actually came down. Now we're sort of seeing the light at the end of the tunnel where, you know, we're expecting pretty soon in the second half of this year that the Bank of Canada is going to be in a position to start easing up on those interest rates. As that happens, we do think that some of the demand will return to the housing market. And we're going to see, as that happens, some upward pressure resume on prices. And unfortunately, that's going to mean some challenges for affordability over the years ahead.
Right. In terms of where you're seeing, because I know this is regional to some extent, but I was surprised to see that with so much emphasis on housing starts, I was surprised to see that in some of those areas where housing prices are a real issue, like Vancouver and Toronto, that housing starts are actually not increasing. There must be a lot of reasons for that.
Well, you know, a lot of it has to do with a bit of an overhang from last year. And so in Toronto and Vancouver, last year, you know, even though, you know, we were in a period of high interest rates, there was still a very, very high level of construction, particularly of large apartment buildings. So that can be rental or condo apartment buildings. A lot of these larger projects, the financing is sort of arranged well in advance. So the conditions for that construction didn't really reflect the economic reality of last year when we saw the big increase in interest rates, because a lot of that financing had been prearranged. Now, as we see 2024, there's a lot of units under construction, but you know, from all the market intelligence gathering that we've done, it looks like in these centers, there's going to be a bit of a lull in multifamily starts this year. And that's really what's driving what we see for housing starts this year. It's multi starts in some of these large centers that are sort of coming off high levels, but now the construction will reflect the current economic reality, which is higher interest rates.
Right. And I mean, on the ground, that looks like yet another dip for 2023 and going forward as well. How big a dip are we seeing? And of course, already we were below what the CMHC had forecasted would be needed over the next several years to try and maintain or at least achieve some sort of level of affordability.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, a couple years ago in 2021, housing starts were close to 270,000, just a little over that, in fact. And every year since then, we've seen starts move lower. In 2023, they came in at about 240,000 starts. And this year, we're forecasting about 224,000 housing starts. And so we're moving down in terms of the level. It's still a historically high level, but it falls way short of what we need in order to reestablish balance between supply and demand, which will bring about better affordability. We actually think the pace of starts needs to pretty much double each and every year between now and 2030. In order to eliminate the gap in supply. And clearly that's not happening in this forecast. And that's why I said earlier, a bit concerned for me about the path for affordability going forward, because we have very strong demand, very strong population growth in Canada. These things put pressure on not just ownership housing, but rental housing as well. And with the stock not growing quickly enough, because starts aren't doubling in this forecast, we're seeing, you know, pressure on affordability in our forecast. That means higher house prices and higher rent increases as well.
Yeah, perhaps a bit about that, because I know people are already struggling. I mean, the idea was that as interest rates stayed high, prices would come down. And what I think you're saying in this report is that if anything, by 2026, we could see housing prices start to creep up to where they were sort of at the height of that boom around the pandemic in 2022.
Absolutely. And we have seen house prices come down since, you know, about March of 2022, when the bank started its hiking of interest rates. Prices have certainly come down. But, you know, because of higher interest rates, so the mortgage carrying costs have actually increased. And so the decrease in prices was more than offset by higher mortgage rates, you know, and so that's really had been a challenge for affordability. But going forward, we do think as interest rates come down, we're going to see renewed demand. And as you said, by early next year, the average house price will get back up to the level that we saw in about February of 2022 before the rate hikes began.
Wow. And that is more or less universal, because I know there's regional differences, obviously, but are you seeing that sort of across the board?
Yes, to varying degrees across the board, but really because interest rates affect mortgage rates in the same way across the country, that's being one of the main drivers of house prices. You know, there are regional variations because, you know, in some places, population growth will be stronger than others. But overall, we're seeing an upward trend in house prices over the next couple of years.
There's been a lot of announcements, obviously, both provincially, federally, and so on. I don't know how much those factored into your forecast, but we're certainly seeing a lot of attention being paid to the housing file, which must warm your heart to some extent. But I suppose all of it has a lag in it, right? And what your report is about is really the immediate future.
Well, right. And you know, to the extent possible, you know, these forecasts take time to put together. So a certain number of these announcements are included in our forecast. But as you know, at some point when, you know, further announcements are made, they can't all be taken into account because we don't keep updating in real time. But certainly, you know, the work that we do at CMHC to sort of highlight the supply shortage in the housing market, I think, has been influential in steering housing policy in the recent years. And we're seeing much more of the housing policy around trying to increase supply in order to restore affordability. And so, you know, you don't have to go back too far in the past to 10 years ago. Most of the policies would have been around demand side measures to restrict access to home ownership in order to calm down the growth in house prices. Now we're seeing more of a policy tilt towards getting new supply out there. And I think that in part because of the work that we do, and it is heartwarming to see that response. The scary part, though, is as good as that response has been, it's not enough, because we aren't seeing the increase in housing starts needed to get that, you know, supply gap closed by 2030. And so, you know, this forecast does reflect increasing house prices because of the supply issue.
Yeah, if anything, it continues to go the wrong way, which I'm sure will be made of by the politicians. But from where you sit, feels like, again, it's going to take some time to turn this ship around.
You know, supply takes time. You know, when you think about, you know, large, high density, large apartment buildings, you know, in a place like Toronto, but by the time, if you know, if you decide today that you want to build a building, it can take up to 10 years for that building to be completed and so that people can move in. And so supply isn't an instant solution and it takes time. In the meantime, we have to find ways, whether that's laneway housing, basement apartments, ways to increase the use of existing supply, because it does take time to get built. And so, and that's not a very, it's not a happy piece of news for folks that are struggling to afford where they live currently. And if supply takes time, it there's a bit of patience required before that supply has an impact on affordability. And so it can be a challenging time. And that's why we use the word crisis when we talk about affordability. We don't like to throw words around like that very loosely, but it is for many Canadians, a crisis situation. I talked about the housing market briefly, but the rental market briefly, sorry. But yeah. When you look at
We'll get to the rental market. I was just about to. Bob Dugan is chief economist with the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation. They have new numbers out now on housing in this country. If you're stuck in an unaffordable situation or hoping to buy, the news isn't great. Housing starts are down, predicted to be down in 2024 compared to 2023 and even 2022. So it's going in the wrong direction, whereas the CMHC has been warning for ages now that we need to double the number of housing starts by 2030 to at least achieve some measure of affordability. And of course, that also means, you know, when it comes to supply and demand, the population continues to grow, that prices again are expected to reach those new highs by 2026, similar to what we saw back in 2022. Bob, you were talking about rentals just before we took a quick break there. Obviously, if you're in the rental market, it's not looking so rosy either, because it's been absorbing a lot of this excess demand, and rents, obviously, because of it, have been going up, and they will continue to do so, you think?
I think so. And you, if you look at the results from our rental market survey that we published a few months ago, you can really see in the rent data some of the supply shortages and how that's pressuring rents and making rental market less affordable. And that really concerns me, because many of the most vulnerable Canadians, lower income Canadians, they get their housing in the rental market. And if you can't afford the rental market, where do you turn for affordable housing? It can be a big problem. And, you know, we capture rents now, and we look at rents in units where there's been turnover of a tenant. Mm-hmm. And compare that to where there is no turnover, because many people, if the unit doesn't turn over, in other words, the tenant stays in place, that rent can be protected by rent control in many provinces across Canada. Whereas when the tenant moves out and the new one moves in, those rents often reset to what the market will bear. And it really yields some scary results, really. And so for Canada, in non-turnover units, again, those are units where no one moved, average rents were up about 5.1% last year. But in units where there was turnover, so, you know, someone moved out, someone else moved in, 24% increase in rents. Now, that's Canada-wide. Wow. There are certain centers where the story is even scarier. So Toronto, for example, in non-turnover units, rent increases were about 4.4%. If someone moved out, someone else moved in it. So a turnover unit, the rent was up 40% in Toronto.
Wow, that's a huge number. I know there's been some announcements recently to try to, you know, find a way to publish those numbers and so on beforehand, but it feels like the market is so competitive right now that it's basically we're in a landlord's world right now, because there is so much demand for these units that they can actually afford to jack up the prices like that, and there's not much individual tenants can do. You know, God forbid they lose their place for whatever reason and have to find another rental in the same market.
Or, you know, if it can limit labor mobility, if you want to accept a job somewhere else and you want to move closer to that job, you might not be able to afford to take on this higher paying job if your rent's going to go up 40% because you have to move across town. It can really be a problem for folks. And so, you know, we're very concerned about that. And it's certainly a world where there's a supply shortage. It's not just for ownership housing that's driving house prices higher, but it's, you know, in the rental market, which drives rents higher. And the solution is really to get more units built. We need a better balance between supply and demand. And, you know, in recent years with high levels of immigration, you know, immigrants, when they first come to Canada, they first tend to settle in the rental market. Eventually they move on into home ownership, but that puts pressure on rent. But with high mortgage rates as well, if a lot of potential home buyers weren't able to make the leap to home ownership, they stayed in the rental market. And all this means added demand for rental. And over the near future, we don't see that abating too much. And we think vacancy rates are likely to remain under pressure. And as a result, we'll continue to see strong rent growth that outpaces the growth in income. And that's the scary part because, again, affordability deteriorating.
And I suppose the message from the CMHC, as has been your message in the past, is simply there needs to be a lot more housing starts, and we're just not seeing them yet.
Absolutely. We have to find a way to build more. And we are building a fair number of housing starts, even though there's a slowdown this year to about 224,000 starts. That's a historically fairly high level. Mm-hmm. You know, the unemployment rate is really low right now. It's gone up since it was at its lowest, but it's still historically low. So it's not like there's a lot of unemployed people that we can just deploy to build houses. We have to find a way to be more productive in the way we build houses, use innovations to try to get more built with existing resources, because we don't have a lot of spare resources to throw at the problem. So we have to figure out clever ways to do more with what we have and become more efficient at building homes.
Bob, as always, thank you.
My pleasure.
If you're listening and you have a favorite mall, a mall that sort of symbolized what it was like to be at the mall, quote unquote, the way we used to describe it back in the 80s and the 90s and so on, let me know which one it is. We'll pay tribute to some of those great malls out there tonight. 1-877-399-9898 is the text line. 1-877-399-9898. I mentioned that I kind of grew up sort of more central, so we didn't have a mall right near where I lived. We had downtown in Montreal. But I used to love the mall. I'd go visit my cousins at Etobicoke. They lived out near the airport. And we'd go to a place called Sherway and then Square One in Mississauga. And I thought these meccas. They were impressive if you didn't get to go to one very often. And, you know, Gen X was really kind of the mall generation. If you go back and watch movies like Fast Times at Ridgemont High, half the movie is set around the mall. It's where people had their first jobs. It's where they hung out. It's where they took their cues, both, you know, from clothing to music and everything else, you name it, hanging out with friends and so on. As Catherine from Surrey put it, you know, Sam the Record Man, Radio Shack, Fairweather's, Bowring's, The Bay were in my mall where I lived as a teen. It was the best mall ever. And I think a lot of us have those memories of the mall. Now, of course, of late, if you've been to a mall, not all malls, but many of them, it's much quieter there than it used to be. In fact, a lot of them are almost like ghost towns. It's lost its central spot in society in so many ways. Online shopping, of course, so much what we did at the mall has now gravitated online, whether it be socializing or buying stuff. And that's led to the collapse of department stores, the end of record stores. The list goes on and on and on. And as it goes on and on and on, it kind of hollows out the mall, and everything is more virtual than bricks and mortar these days. There's an irony there, of course, because malls themselves were often blamed for hollowing out those famed downtown shopping strips of the previous generation. So what goes around comes around in retail often. And these are all items, are themes my next guest explores in a new book called Big Mall, Shopping for Meaning. Kate Black grew up in the shadow of perhaps Canada's most famous, well, certainly Canada's most famous mall, one of the most famous malls in the world, the Great Edmonton Mall. And, you know, your local mall on steroids, as it's been called, that had an indoor water park, an aquarium, a roller coaster. I've only been there once, and it was on an election tour, and I don't remember enough about it. And when I lived in Edmonton, it wasn't built yet. That's how long ago that was. Again, it remains one of the biggest malls in the world, behind places such as the Dubai Mall in Dubai. I've been there. They have a ski, amongst other things. And this famously empty South China Mall in Dongguan, China, that is absolutely massive, but 90% void. In fact, there's a YouTube channel now that you can watch, or many, that show people exploring abandoned malls across North America. Here's one of the Montgomery Mall in Montgomery, Alabama, which closed for good back in 2008.
The color palette is so 90s. Like, this is the color palette I remember from going to malls as a kid.
Not much left in here.
Especially in Florida.
Here's the center court.
We've called a lot of malls that we've been to apocalyptic feeling, but this is probably the most apocalyptic feeling one we've ever been to.
Apocalyptic. That's quite, I mean, you can imagine it. It's just empty, right? Kate Black, again, her book is called Big Mall, Shopping for Meaning, and she joins me now. Kate, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
What an interesting idea for a book. I mean, I've always been fascinated by malls, given the generation I'm of. But you grew up in the shadow of the biggest one, perhaps the most famous one. What was the inspiration for putting it all down on paper?
Yeah, so I grew up in St. Albert, Alberta. It's just right outside of Edmonton. And kind of like you were alluding to, West Edmonton Mall plays a huge part of your life when you're a kid growing up in and around Edmonton. Like, it's where you do all your back-to-school shopping. Like, it's where your parents or your teachers reward you. If you've been well-behaved, you get a trip to West Edmonton Mall. And then all the other stuff tied into that, like, it's where we kind of create our identities, like buying the clothes that'll help us fit in with the clique that we want to be a part of, or, you know, it's the first place that we're really let loose away from adults. And so just thinking about what a huge role it plays in Albertans' life, I thought it was kind of interesting that no one has written a full-length literary nonfiction book about this place. So not just recording like a fact or like a Wikipedia page of what happened there, but really like digging into what does this all mean? Like, how does a space like this affect people like me or affect other Edmontonians? But then also like everyone, like you were talking about in the introduction, has a mall that's close to them. So I don't know, what does it mean to grow up in the age of malls? I wanted to dig into that.
Yeah, I think I called it the Great Edmonton Mall. It was a type of the West Edmonton Mall, of course. As I said, when I lived in Edmonton, it was just being built, believe it or not. That's how long ago I lived in Edmonton. It's interesting, though, because the way you've shaped it is sort of this idea of the mall as both good and bad. And I think that was always the attitude a lot of my parents, for instance, had towards malls, because for them, they remembered sort of downtowns being busy and people going downtown to shop. And all of a sudden, it was replaced by these big, huge megalith structures out in the burbs where you could park. But you've really looked into the whole idea of how they're both good and bad.
Yeah, it's like a love-hate relationship, which ironically I think somehow, or how some people feel about Alberta as well, like you love to hate it, you hate to love it. I don't know. Yeah, I feel like when I walk through the mall, I feel those both strong feelings on both ends. Like, it's such an overwhelming space to be in, but I also feel pretty like elated, like when you're buying that new purchase or you're getting a sale. So I don't know. I think it speaks to the times that we're living in for sure.
When you went back into it, and of course you go into the history of malls a little bit, and I guess a lot of this, Victor Gruen is a name that comes up a lot because he both kind of conceived of what the mall might look like, turning shopping inside out. And then when he passed, he hated the mall. By the time he passed, he hated them. But anyway, interesting.
Yeah. Almost, I guess maybe a tragic story, almost like a Shakespearean tragedy in some ways. Like, so when Victor Gruen, the inventor of malls, he immigrated to the States to flee the Nazis. He really wanted to bring life into the suburbs, and he was really nostalgic for those high streets from his native Vienna. Flash forward a few decades after malls were built, and he realized that it just sucked all the life out of the cities that he loved. And he also originally imagined that malls would be these multiplexes, so not just of shopping, but also like schools, like dentist offices, grocery stores. And some malls, of course, fulfill those purposes. But what really took off was just the idea of having this indoor shopping space. It's tragic. He actually really like rued his invention on his deathbed. He resented the fact that they existed.
How should we take then? Because obviously I've been to malls. It's interesting because if you go to places like Asia, the malls are still booming and they've kind of adapted them. Like, you know, malls in southern China are kind of selfie destinations. So they're a little bit about shopping, but they're basically destinations, right? They have art in the wall and places you can go. But when you go to the good old fashioned North American suburban mall, they're awfully quiet these days. And I guess we're witnessing the end of an era sort of. And I'm wondering in the context of the book, how you approach that.
Yeah, it's so fascinating, kind of the place that we're in. We're almost like at this precipice of like, is the mall going to live? Is it going to die? And I think the answer is that like all malls are doing differently. So some suburban malls, like I'm thinking of the malls in St. Albert where I grew up, they're very quiet. But when I go to West Edmonton Mall or when I go to Metrotown Mall in Burnaby, I live in Vancouver now, they're booming. Like, it's too busy. It's overwhelming how many people are there. So I think one of the takeaways is that like big malls are doing better than ever. And there's a lot of reasons why that is. Like, one of the reasons is that they still have those big stores that people want to shop at. A lot of them still have those anchor stores. But I think there's just something too about like like the tactile experience. Like there's kind of a meme right now about Sephora kids. So maybe instead of mall rats, now we see a bunch of like 13-year-old girls like trying on makeup in Sephora. And I think it's kind of annoying when you're just like an adult trying to buy makeup in these spaces. But I think it shows like kids still want to go to the mall. Like mall rats still exist, but you just have taken a different form.
Yeah, and things have changed. I guess you're right. I mean, one of the things I found interesting as well is that with the dominance of these mega malls now, so you mentioned Metrotown, which I've been to, and obviously the West Edmonton Mall, is it doesn't matter where you are in the world, more or less, the malls now look alike. They didn't used to. Now they do. Mm-hmm. Now a mall in Hong Kong looks like a mall in Vancouver that looks like a mall in Toronto and elsewhere.
Yeah. There's a part in the book I talk about how it's kind of disappointing. Like, I remember having this feeling of recently going to a mall in Las Vegas and thinking, like, I've been here before, but I haven't been here. And it's almost the feeling of, you know, like going to a Starbucks or a McDonald's in a new place. It's like, are there authentic experiences anymore?
Yeah, you know, that part of it is interesting as well, because I suppose it makes sense for the mall owners to recreate that experience, because obviously it works. You dug into a little bit of the psychology of malls, too. I remember reading somewhere that malls are supposed to make you forget about time, a bit like casinos, and that part of the way they're designed is supposed to, and this, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, is you're supposed to easily get lost, because the comfort you seek, the sort of the comfort of finding your parents when you get lost at the grocery store, is actually buying something. And so it's all it's a bit devilish psychologically.
Yeah. Oh, I love the way that you put that, like how, because that's 100% true. Like it's called the Gruen effect, actually, which I think is also why he felt such resentment towards that. Like, you know, that daze that you feel, and it's almost like the only remedy for that is more shopping, whether it's like even, you know, stumbling into the food court and randomly spending $20, because it's like, I just have to like up my blood sugar, else I'm going to pass out. Or finding respite in like Uniqlo, because that's my safe space, I guess. It's so interesting to think that those are the spaces that we are almost like forced to seek comfort in these really dizzying spaces.
Kate Black is with me this half hour. Her book is called Big Mall, Shopping for Meaning. West Edmonton Mall is kind of the jumping off point for it, but it's about malls in general. So Kate, I think there's a lot of nostalgia now online for sort of mall life as it once was. I should remind anyone who's younger out there, if you're listening, it wasn't that cool. It was fun but everything was there, right? I mean, your music store was there. Like, you sort of, all that stuff is no longer, you don't have to go to a mall to find that anymore. So where to now then for the mall, do you think?
Man, that's a good question. I wish I had a crystal ball, because I'm genuinely curious. I think the big malls are here to stay. I think people will travel far and wide to go to their Uniqlos, their Sephoras, their World Water Parks, West Edmonton Mall. I guess maybe what I'm thinking about recently is what's going to happen when these smaller malls close. And we already know that so many have already closed. Where are people going to go and just hang out inside? Like, I think it's a really important question to ask living in a place like Canada, where our climate can be pretty hostile in the winter. And I think that might be a big part of the nostalgia that people have for their community malls. Like, it was the place that they could just go and congregate, somewhere that wasn't a home, where you didn't even necessarily have to buy anything, just to go sit at a table inside. So I think it points towards this need for indoor space that's accessible to all sorts of different kinds of people. And I hope there's something that fills that gap for it, if it's not necessarily malls.
Yeah, you talked about that too, because I remember, of course, when I was working in Toronto as a reporter, we did a story on mall walkers once. And of course, the mall itself was pretty abandoned, but the mall walkers loved it. And they were, you know, older, and they would hang out, and that's where they would go meet. And, you know, for that generation that isn't online, the mall sort of still served a purpose as a gathering spot. You could park, you could walk in, you know, it felt safe. There was security. I mean, there was a lot to the mall that wasn't about shopping. And it's interesting to think of how much malls became useful in many different ways over the years.
Yeah, and it's so tied to their history of malls were built like in conjunction with the development of the suburbs. So people moving out of these more congested urban spaces into, you know, their own homes, like their own places with yards. But it's like you can't deny that it's a more isolated way of living. It's really hard when you have to walk, you know, 2 minutes over to your neighbor's door for a cup of sugar. You might not even know their name. So I guess malls have filled in that gap, and it's sad to think about what will happen if they go away.
Yeah. It's been interesting to see how well received your book has as well. I mean, you were interviewed by the Washington Post reviewed it. The Toronto Star has had an excerpt of it. Mm-hmm. There's obviously a lot of interest in this topic. And I found that to be interesting as well, because quietly malls have kind of started to disappear. The smaller ones, the bigger ones, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. Most of them are still doing okay. But there is this kind of idea that the mall is disappearing, and perhaps we should have spent more time looking into just how important a part of our fabric it actually is.
Yeah. And I wonder too, how much of that is, you know, there's the nostalgia for the mall, but it's also everything that the mall represented, like this period of time that just felt a little more contained and predictable. I even feel like the way that we shop and just engage with like capitalism, like has gotten so much more confusing, like crypto and Bitcoin, like it's like shopping online, credit cards, like it's just not as simple as going down to the record store and buying a record. I think that it sounds like a nice time.
It does. And I mean, I think there was something to the idea that even though the whole purpose of the mall was to get you to spend money, oftentimes as a teenager, when you barely had any money, you could go to the mall and hang out and eat maybe something small, go get a record, and you could probably have a whole day at the mall and get out of there for what was affordable. And those things don't exist much anymore either. Like every place you set foot in is expensive. That's why when you go to something like Metrotown in Burnaby, BC, or you go to the Carrefour Laval in Montreal, or it's full of people and they're not all necessarily all there spending money.
No. I don't know if this is funny, but when I was at Burnaby or at Metrotown recently, there was an old man sleeping on a couch and a guy kind of went up and poked him to make sure he was okay. But it was nice that this old guy was just able to like have a nap, snoring, probably all his family was out shopping elsewhere. Like he didn't have to spend money to have a good time at the mall.
Yeah. So have you learned anything through this whole process? I mean, you sat down, wrote the book, researched it, put it out. Now you've had replies to it. I'm sure people tell you about their mall experiences. What have you learned from all of this so far?
Oh, wow. I guess, to be honest, I went into writing the book feeling quite pessimistic about malls. Like there's a lot to be critical about with malls. They don't always feel great and they don't always treat people very well. But I think through writing the book and through, you know, having conversations like this of all the great memories and experiences people have had in malls, it really shows me like I learned a lot about how essential human connection is and how people will always seek it out, even when our physical environment kind of pulls us apart in a lot of ways. Like the mall is evidence that we want to have a community, even if it's a place that's purely built for shopping.
Yeah. And I suppose in that sense, it was never really about, because I think part of the problem with malls is that it's not like those old buildings downtown, or maybe they will be eventually. Maybe there will be a resurrection of mall architecture. Yeah. It'll become trendy eventually to sort of turn those old malls, suburban malls, the ones that are now being abandoned, into something new and glorious. But for the time being, they're just kind of empty and unfortunate.
Yeah, it's like we have to figure this out. Like I know there's a mall, Eau Claire Mall. I recently went there in Calgary and it's completely empty now because it's going to be demolished for public transit, which I guess is like, it's positive. That'll be a good thing. But I've seen that other malls have been, some have even changed their spaces into like homeless shelters. Like we have the space, like there has to be something done with it.
Yeah. Well, Kate, congratulations on the book. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me, Ben.
NATO turned 75 today. Here is NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg.
Just 14 paragraphs over a few pages. Never has a single document with so few words meant so much to so many people. So much security, so much prosperity, and so much peace.
There you have it. The North Atlantic Treaty was signed 75 years ago today by a dozen nations, including Canada. We're one of the founding members. So Foreign ministers, including Melanie Joly, were gathered at NATO headquarters in Brussels today to mark the 75th anniversary of the alliance. It comes just a few weeks after Sweden joined to increase membership now to 32, so up 20 from where it began back in 1949. And that is 1 billion people that live in those 32 countries on both sides of the Atlantic, including on this side we are. Now, after going through a real period of change following the end of the Cold War, including expansion into Eastern Europe, and, of course, the Afghanistan conflict, NATO at 75, strangely enough, now finds itself in a very similar place that it was when it first began, which is counter the growing threat from Russia, protect each other, this sort of idea of mutual defense, and all of it kind of with America in the lead again under the shield of American nuclear weapons. Cold War 2.0, if you want to call it that. I don't know if we want to go that far just yet. But of course, there's a war raging on the alliance's borders involving a country looking to become a new member one day soon. And Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba was there today. He hopes that NATO will not forget that his nation is under siege.
I didn't want to spoil the birthday party for NATO, but I felt compelled to deliver a very sobering message on behalf of Ukrainians about the state of Russian air attacks on my country, destroying our energy system, our economy, killing civilians.
Of course, a big test for NATO is the war in Ukraine. It's amazing how united NATO has remained. Of course, that may change. You know, there's a U.S. presidential election coming up 7 months from tomorrow, believe it or not. And one candidate, Donald Trump, of course, in his time in power, and again, has been talking pretty openly about how much he doesn't like the NATO structure. Feels like it's basically America protecting everyone else. They're not getting their money back. So that is a bit of an existential threat for the alliance right now. And what about Canada? I mean, Canada's come under a lot of criticism, especially internally, for not really living up or never living up to that 2% of GDP spending on defense. Of course, we're nowhere near that. Canada stood up in other ways. Of course, we went to Afghanistan and so on. But that number has rankled for quite a while, and it feels like a lot of the newer members do meet that target. So where does Canada stand here on the 75th anniversary, having been one of the founding members of the alliance? We put those questions to Stephen Saidman, who's Patterson Chair in International Affairs at the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs at Carleton. He joins me tonight from Berlin, which is a pretty appropriate place to be marking the 75th anniversary of NATO. Stephen, thanks for your time.
My pleasure, Ben.
Quite the place to be on the 75th anniversary of NATO, kind of right in the heart of what was sort of the front lines of the Cold War back in the day.
Indeed. I remarked on social media today that NATO's record in its day job is perfect. It has not been attacked by the Soviet Union or Russia, and that's what it was built for.
Yeah. Tell me a bit about where here we are at the 75th anniversary. And it feels like in many ways it's you know, it's just a day, but it feels like it is a time for reckoning for an organization that started off small, has gotten much bigger, but its core purpose and its core foe seems to remain the same 75 years later.
Yeah, we went through a period in the 1990s and early 2000s where NATO was looking for a new reason to exist. There was an existential crisis every day about what to do. And for the 1990s, that became what they call crisis management, which was trying to minimize the conflicts in the Balkans. And then it became about Afghanistan. And then there was a debate for a while about whether the threat was to the East or whether the threat was from instability in the Middle East and in Africa, which was really about certain countries and the alliance facing refugees. And thanks to Russia, since 2014, NATO's discovered its mojo, that its major mission and its old playbooks are mostly coming back and dusted off, or how did it deter the foe from the East?
Right. It's been amazing to see. I mean, now with the additions of Finland and Sweden, and then, of course, over the course of the last 25 years since the 50th anniversary, sort of the growth of NATO to include former Soviet bloc countries, Balkan countries, and so on. It has been a time of great growth. Is it a stronger organization now as a bigger organization?
I think with size comes complexity. So it has definitely more assets now in terms of more countries with more perspectives and with a variety of forces to throw at things. I think one of the challenges was that the security of the 1990s and the early 2000s meant that many of the countries cut their militaries by quite a bit. So in terms of military strength, we don't have as many forces as we did 30 years ago. I think that we have more countries that are more resolute now than they've been in a long, long time because of the Russian threat.
It was interesting to see Jens Stoltenberg today. And of course, the NATO ministers are gathered in Brussels to mark it. The Washington Treaty has made the trip, been brought from Washington to Brussels to mark the occasion. It was interesting to see the threats they discuss now, because there is one that is clearly an external threat, which is Russia. And they continue to talk about that today. And Ukraine, we can talk about that as well. But the other one is the idea of another Trump presidency and what kind of internal threat could be happening. And the word de-Trump, or sort of Trump-proofing NATO, has been an interesting one that's being thrown around all of a sudden.
Yes, I think for a long time, the concern was that maybe Russia would do something that would cause NATO to not fulfill its commitments. And that might lead to the end of NATO. Whereas today, I think most allies are most concerned not about that, because the alliance has been resolute, as I said before, against the Russian threat. I think the biggest concern really is Donald Trump, that if Donald Trump were to become president, that NATO would cease to exist, or at least the American involvement would be over. And since that has been one of the key pillars of the entire alliance, it's always been about the American commitment to Europe. If that commitment goes away, then maybe the alliance itself goes away.
Yeah. I mean, the Europeans often talk of sort of trying to step up and fill that void. Is that even conceivable?
It's going to be really, it would be very, very difficult for a couple of reasons. One is that the American nuclear deterrent is a fundamental part of NATO, and that would go away. And while the British and the French have nuclear weapons, the French don't consider their nuclear weapons to be used for deterrent attacks upon anybody else. And the British, since 2016, have not been the best playmates for Europe. So that would be a major change. And what people forget for any kind of military operation is it's not just the American troops. It's all the American, what they call enablers. So it's the satellites, it's the technology, it's the intelligence, it's all the infrastructure that makes it easier for countries to fight, the headquarters, all that sort of stuff that the Americans bring to the table. And if the United States were to pull out of Europe, then it would take a while for the Europeans to find substitutes for that stuff.
Interesting. 75 years later, and here we are, right? Russia's still the foe, and the Americans are still essentially the core of NATO.
Yes, well, in part because the Americans have been very comfortable in the leading role. Other countries have not really stepped up. I'm in Germany right now, and you know, Germany's been involved in this huge debate for a long time, and they really focused on their peace dividend in the aftermath of the war. People forget that Germany had the second largest land war army amongst all the European countries during the Cold War, and then they shrunk quite a bit, and they haven't really been that capable since then. And everybody's sort of nervous about German promises, and Germans are nervous about keeping their promises. And they made a big commitment last year, 2 years ago, to spend a lot more money in their defense. They've talked about having a completely different change of perspective about Russia. But the question is, will they actually follow through on all that? And it's not clear that they are making that much progress on a lot of those promises.
It was interesting looking back at some of what was written 10 years ago on the 65th anniversary, and how much of it was around sort of Europe having to get off its dependence on Russian energy, the threat to Ukraine, and so on. And here we are 10 years later. And of course, all of that has come to fruition. The whole debate around Ukraine is obviously an integral one to the alliance right now, because essentially there is a war going on in Europe with Russia and NATO and Ukraine on the front line. And yeah, we've seen politics in the U.S. get involved in this as well. So no doubt, as we mark 75 years, there is very much a pressing and urgent security crisis going on that NATO is part of.
Well, the war with Ukraine has done a couple of different things for us. It's given us a lot more confidence in the alliance. I mean, on two measures. One is, the alliance has really held together on this. There hasn't been real divisions. The sanctions have been mostly observed, but most of the alliance, pretty much every NATO ally has given significant military equipment to Ukraine. There are varying degrees of enthusiasm, but I mean, every country has really stepped up to give at least some assistance to Ukraine. Nobody's taking the Russian side on this within NATO. Some of the allies that we were most nervous about, such as Turkey, have been actually pretty pro-Ukraine in all this. Hungary has been sort of annoying, but we kind of expected that. On the other side of the table, one of the most striking things about this entire war has been that Putin and Russia have not tested NATO. That is, they have not hit any NATO country with a conventional attack. There's been, you know, some various sabotage, cyber attacks, you know, political interference, but we haven't seen any Russian missiles cross into NATO territory. We haven't seen any planes or helicopters or any efforts to try to just poke at all to test the alliance. Putin wants to keep the alliance out of the war, and that has deterrent attacks on the alliance. And so in some ways, the alliance is working better than we could possibly imagine.
Steve Saidman is the Patterson Chair in International Affairs at Carleton University. He's in Berlin tonight. We're talking about the 75th anniversary of NATO, which is today, back in 1949. The Washington Treaty created. Canada was, of course, one of the 12 founding members of the alliance. Stephen, looking at, there's a graph that was put out, I think, by another academic recently that was taken from somewhere, but it just showed that sort of Canada's defense spending is way below the NATO 2% commitment, and its defense spending on equipment or equipment spending as part of its defense budget is also very low. So you look at this chart of sort of defense spending on the NATO alliance side, and there's Canada all by itself down in the left corner in not a particularly enviable place. Here we are 75 years after becoming one of the founding members of the alliance. How is Canada seen then now, do you think?
Well, to be fair, Canada spends a lot more time thinking about how people think about Canada than other people actually are thinking
true
about
enough,
Canada.
True enough, yes.
Right. And when the Germans criticize Canadians for not doing the right things on spending, then we can just scoff in their general direction because the Germans have been underspending for years.
Right.
And I think we could also look at our record in Kandahar and in Libya and Iraq and other places. And Canada has always shown up and done the things that have been necessary for the alliance, much more so than a country that maybe spent more.
Right.
The 2% metric I always hammer about is that Greece on that metric looks fantastic, but Greece never shows up, and its troops are mostly pointing their guns at another NATO ally. So, but the 2% thing matters. It matters in diplomacy. And I think more importantly, the Canadian military actually does need more money, whether it's to forgetting about the commitment to Europe for a second, just to keep the promises it made over the years, to have a significant military that is well-trained, is well-equipped, that is asked to do a whole lot, both domestically and internationally, it needs more money. But in terms of the 2% thing, yeah, we underspend by quite a bit for that metric, and it does create diplomatic friction for us. I don't think it's the primary reason why we should spend more money in our military, but it is a reason, and it is not a bad reason, but it is just one of many reasons that Canada needs to spend more. But I would say again, at most occasions, people aren't spending most of their time thinking about, oh, if only Canada spent more, we'd be in great shape. It's just not the thing.
Yeah. We could be a bit myopic here, can't we? Yeah.
Yeah. I will say Canada has made a bunch of commitments that, if they follow through on them, will require a lot more money to be spent. That's NORAD modernization. That's the F-35s. It's the shipbuilding program. I mean, the joy of the shipbuilding program is we're going to spend a lot of money on ships that may never, be built or sold or on the seas, but it'll help us get to 2%. So isn't that great?
Yeah. I guess your sense then is that there's more to this than just that 2% number is thrown around all the time, but there's more to a commitment to an alliance than the spending. Obviously Canada gets criticized, especially internally, about that number. But you point out that Canada has been there when the alliance needed countries to step up.
Exactly. I mean, the Afghanistan, the only way we can explain Canada's involvement in Afghanistan was it was a part of the commitment to an ally that had been attacked, that indeed in the aftermath of 9/11, that the United States was actually in some ways reluctant to invoke Article 5. Article 5 was always, it was designed as an attack upon one equals an attack upon all. It was aimed at protecting Europe, not the United States. But Canada was one of the ones that led the effort to get that commitment made because it felt that it was important for the ally that had been attacked to get support. And Canada came through in Kandahar in 2002, in Kabul the next year, and then back in Kandahar in 2005 to 2011. And then training Afghans for another few more years. Canada showed up in Libya. It's one of the few countries that was actually able and willing to hit moving targets in Libya. Four out of the entire alliance were willing to do that. So Canada has always contributed significantly to every NATO mission. And so those contributions are real, but people have short memories. Politicians change. NATO is like any insurance program. You can't stop paying and expect that your payments 5 years ago are to cover you today. Everybody's got to keep on contributing. Canada has to keep on contributing. It is now. It is one of the major contributors to the mission in the Baltics. The big question I think people have in Europe about Canada is not that it's not spending enough, but whether they can actually do enough to support that mission. That is a big commitment. To have something like 2,000 troops in Latvia for an extended period of time. Everybody's having to extend themselves quite a bit to do that. And so I think if you ask Europeans about Canada's presence in Europe, if they think about it at all, I think it's going to be about whether Canada can sustain that particular commitment.
Yeah, I guess there is so much else going on in a 32-member alliance where Canada isn't a prominent figure. Although, I mean, as one of the founding members of the alliance, it feels like over the 75 years, Canada has both contributed but also very much benefited from its NATO membership.
Sure. I mean, Canada has a more of a presence and an influence in Europe than what otherwise. That it is, you know, has equal voting rights as everybody else. It was one of the leading countries in Afghanistan, helped shape the mission in Afghanistan in a way that hadn't happened earlier because, again, it was doing more in a harder part of Afghanistan than a lot of other countries. So Canada gets a lot out of the alliance, although Canada itself is also very reluctant to invoke the alliance. Canada does not want NATO to be making policy in the Arctic because it would rather just have the bilateral relation to the United States be the sort of set the tone of things in the Arctic. So, you know, the Norwegians and the Swedes and the Finns and other folks would certainly like to have more NATO in the Arctic, and right now Canada has been ambivalent about that. So that's a different part of the puzzle that is always being worked on.
Well, Stephen, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your stay in Berlin.
My pleasure, Ben. Thanks for visiting me.
Let's go to Haiti now, because we talked about the situation in Haiti with the Canadian ambassador to Haiti a little while ago. Since then, of course, nothing much has changed, except that Canada is now getting its citizens out of there at this point in time, including a lot of the non-essential embassy staff. But, you know, the UN has issued a really blunt warning about the situation in Haiti and is calling for immediate action to stop what they call as a worsening catastrophe. Now, Haiti's been through just a series of disasters, right? It's been earthquakes, deforestation, and all kinds of terrible stuff. And then politically, it's been a disaster. And obviously, there's this huge issue with gangs and gun violence and so on. But one of the big, and this is not a surprise, I would imagine, but one of the people, obviously the people paying the real price here are just the everyday folks who now can't find enough to eat. The surge in gang violence of late has brought with it a surge in hunger. Close to 5 million people, nearly half of Haiti's population. Keep in mind, Haiti is an island in the middle of the Caribbean. It shares the island of Hispaniola with the Dominican Republic. And way back when, several hundred years ago, it was, or even more recently, it was incredibly rich and fertile. It was an incredible place. And of course, that has changed a lot. So half the country's population, 5 million people, facing food insecurity. Thousands of Haitians have been forced to flee their homes, hindering their access to food as well. And again, nearly 5 million people have food insecurity there. And those who can't access food, well, it's been difficult because food is getting more and more expensive and people are having to leave home and so on. Here is the UN human rights expert, William O'Neill.
There's no way out, air, land, or sea. And in fact, it's not even so open air anymore because people are often afraid to leave their houses. The numbers are all going very much in the wrong direction very quickly.
Joining me now is Paulo Silveri. He's country director for Haiti with the International Fund for Agricultural Development, or IFAD. He's been there for several years now. Thanks so much for your time now.
Thank you for having me.
I guess just to start at the beginning, I mean, you've been there now. You've been there through a very difficult three-year period, I gather, from the assassination of the president on. The situation there now, of course, is even more difficult, I imagine, for the kind of work you're trying to carry out.
Yes, indeed. The situation is harsh, and it's biblical from several perspectives. There is now half of the population in food crisis, over 10% of the population in acute malnutrition, and with children stunting, a very high level of out-migration, over 90% of people with diplomas or degrees or competencies that can support a society at this point in time. 362,000 internally displaced persons recently. Gangs taking control of all entry and exit points of the capital. A very difficult situation. Agricultural production is going down. Imports are difficult. Prices are skyrocketing. So very, very harsh. And it's very hard for us to continue supporting at this point in time.
Yeah, because I gather with what's happened, aid is not getting in. And as you mentioned, with the internal displacement as well of people fleeing the capital, Port-au-Prince, is putting even more pressure on the outlying areas where you do a lot of your work, right?
Yeah, our project, the International Fund for Agricultural Development, or IFAD, works mainly in rural areas. And therefore, we can continue operations as much as FAO, WFP, and others, precisely because we are rural-based in a way. So our financing goes through the Ministry of Economy and Finance through the banking system, which continues working thanks to the e-transactions, thanks to internet in a way, while operations are on the ground, are in the provinces. And therefore, we continue our operations, although at a slower pace, but we continue to support because our approach is bottom-up and we base our interventions on collaborations with civil society organizations, NGOs, cooperatives, associations that keep doing development even under these dire circumstances, with or without external help.
Yeah. How do you continue to operate when the government itself is no longer, well, no longer there or no longer in control? Do you simply continue to operate almost through inertia with the help of these other groups?
Well, the government is there. The government, the prime minister is not in country, but there's an acting prime minister who's the Minister of Economy and Finance, who's doing business as usual, so to speak. He's managing the administration. We work through government, waiting for the Haitians themselves to find a way through this crisis. There's a it's not the UN, it's not the United Nations in this case, but CARICOM, the regional body that that gathers all Caribbean countries, has intermediated for quite a long time now, and they came up with a proposal, the Transitional Presidential Council, which is being set up. So there are discussions, there are talks, there's progress being made. Not everyone agrees with the solutions. The UN system stands ready to support within the limits of our mandate, which is related to the Sustainable Development Goals of the UN system, supporting public policies in doing that. So food security, children support, women empowerment, etc. We stand there to support whatever authorities are legitimately in place. And of course, provided we get the resources to do our job, which is not always the case, unfortunately, but we're still there and we still operate.
Yeah. And on that point, as we look at things, where things stand in April of 2024, just how, I mean, I think a lot of us abroad have been reading about the violence and the unrest. We haven't seen a lot about how much more acute that makes the humanitarian situation, although I think most of us could guess that it's only getting worse. How bad is it? Because one would think that given the circumstances, a lot of the fragile structure that was already in place is probably imperiled at this point.
Well, let me give you a few, very few figures just to set the record. You know, half of the population is food insecure. Since 2023, agricultural production has plummeted. This is FAO speaking. Around 39% for maize, minus 34% for rice, minus 22% for sorghum. The list continues, but the point is that local production is going down. Imports of food are difficult because of gang activities and gangs controlling the territory to a large extent. And also, let us not forget that the more food we import from abroad at very subsidized prices, then the less we support local production. So in a way, there's a conundrum whereby if we intervene in favor of an emergency by importing food, at the same time we damage the local production of agricultural items. And this is why we support WFP and FAO. WFP in particular has a school feeding program which feeds hundreds of thousands of children. And they have a target of local supply reaching 100% of local supply by 2030. And IFAD's project, one of the things we do is increasing local agricultural production so that some of this production can support WFP and FAO in their own relief and emergency programs to feed children and the poor and poor families in general. So we are integrated in the field, but our resources availability is very limited. Indeed, it's much lower than the requirements, and there's a sort of sense that there's a donor's fatigue. Oh, it's Haiti again. There's no progress. We keep pouring money into Haiti, and we don't go very far, or we don't go anywhere. And this, in part, is understandable. It is understandable. But the fact is that the less we invest in development and the more we end up using money for emergency, which is keeping people alive today, but tomorrow we're back to square one. So that is limiting international intervention to security or to emergency, and never allows us to make any progress, because development is where the difference is made, and there's not enough resources for development.
Paulo Silveri is country director for Haiti with the International Fund for Agricultural Development, or IFAD. We're talking about the situation in that Caribbean country right now. Paulo, it's what is the situation now with the land? Because, of course, if you think back, I think, to, you know, Columbus times, I mean, Haiti was, Hispaniola, the island itself, and Haiti were considered sort of the jewels of the Caribbean. I mean, this was some of the most fertile land in the world. And here we are many centuries later, and it feels like even subsistence agriculture can be a bit of a struggle. But what is the condition of trying to get Haiti to find some sort of food sustainability again?
Well, it's a very challenging situation, I must say. They're, you know, synthesizing the history of Haiti would not make justice to the Haitian people, and it would be oversimplifying. It's not something we can do here. But as things stand today, we have an estimated 12 million people living on about one third of the island, which was Hispaniola at the time. There's less than 2% of forest coverage left. There is a very high level of soil degradation and erosion. The western part of the island is highly exposed to natural disasters. Earthquake, the 2010, everybody remembers about, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But there has been another one in 2021, very serious in the south. Extreme natural events are increasingly frequent due to the effects of climate change. Therefore, it's a very challenging territory, and it's a lot of people for this land. Agriculture has been, as you mentioned, Ben, has been export-oriented for a long time. But after, you know, Haiti liberated itself and became an independent nation, the colonial setup of production, scheme of production, was dismantled. And the island moved to different models, and it prioritized at the time subsistence agriculture. But nowadays, you know, it's still looking for its own identity, looking forward. I mean, it is a very proud nation. It is a very proud population, and they have reasons to be. But when it comes to having a common vision of the future, a common vision of society, there you have very different readings of reality and very different projects of country, projects of nations, and projections forward. And that is still not this synthesized in a common plan. So they're still in a phase of discussion, and with lots and lots of Haitians having left the country and being part of the diaspora, but still participating in many ways in the life and destiny of their country. So it's a very complex intersection of interests and populations, and a very hard territory, which makes it that they are still looking for their way forward.
Right. And given that, I suppose right now, once again, we're in a situation where there is a fire. So the fire needs to be doused before we continue on with some of these other larger long-term plans to try to prevent it. You've written, when you first got there, not long after you first got there, about not losing hope when it comes to Haiti. And I think a lot of people look there and think, as you mentioned earlier, oh no, not Haiti again, because it seems like an unsolvable problem. And you don't share that. You think there is still a glimmer of hope there.
There is a lot of hope, and not only hope. I mean, there's work being done. There are things happening, because we should not forget, and this is very important, that the news we hear are mostly about Port-au-Prince, the capital of Haiti. But the rest of the country has a very different reality. The rest of the country have people working, people doing things, people investing, people building and cultivating, and therefore, this is the people we try to support, and we actually support. IFAD has invested about $275 million US dollars since its charter operating there. Our program now is valued about 135 million. We managed to support around 600,000 people through these projects. It's 121,000 families, grosso modo. So, you know, these are facts. It doesn't change the world. It doesn't change the reality for the whole country. But, you know, it changes a lot for those 600,000. And we're just one agency. The World Bank is doing much more. IDB, the Inter-American Development Bank, and all the other UN system, they're all busy investing. So these investments in the countryside, they're making a difference. You have half of the population food insecurity. But without these investments, you know, you would have the totality of the population in food insecurity, because the state is very fragile at this particular point in time. And no private investor would ever go there at this particular point in time. There is a lot of things to be done in perspective. One, the security is reestablished, but not today. So, you know, there's a lot that can be done. It's not only hope that drives us, but it's seeing the effects of these investments, seeing the effects of the work the Haitians do thanks to our resources.
Well, Paulo, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.